All right, welcome to Lecture 16, everybody, for this American History program for the junior and senior high class with History at Our House. On screen immediately is a reminder, which I will post each day, concerning the schedule of activities over the coming 2 weeks. So we are here, evidently, Tuesday, Lecture 16. Tomorrow is Lecture 17, History Through Art. So this week is very normal. The week after, however, contains lots of surprises for people who are new. So we'll keep on talking about that, and hopefully you'll get comfortable with how we are going to proceed as we prepare for our first test. All right, so keep this in mind. Ask me any questions that are nagging at you as they happen to occur to you. For the time being, remember that on the test will be, the first sheet of the test will be a complete survey of all of the anchor facts worth approximately 30 or 35 points. So that's quite a lot. So let's go ahead and get to that. So, prompts, starting with, okay, so let's whip through these as quickly as we possibly can. So, let's get started. Throw your hands up to answer any questions you possibly can. So, well, we'll do them as a group. Sophie, who?
Christopher Columbus.
Okay, hands up, let's go. Juliet, what?
Discovering America.
Okay, when? King?
1492 AD.
Okay, where? We could say Bahamas or America. And then we have so what, Timothy?
If Christopher, there cannot be any United States of America without America being discovered first.
Perfect. Okay, let's move on. Who? Ben?
Founding fathers.
Ashton, what?
The Founding Fathers?
And the question is what?
Okay.
Oh, this has to be a reflex. This is a very famous painting. We have to be very reflexive on this one. Sophie?
Signing of the Declaration.
Declaration of Independence. When, Piper?
July 4th, 1776 AD.
Okay, good. So let's just go with the years for now, because we are not learning anything at this stage of the game that has to be down to the resolution of a single day, right? So I appreciate that you know, and it's just fine, but let's be kind of in our dealings here for the time being. All we need is the year. Where? America/Philadelphia. So what, Ben?
Without the signing of the Declaration of Independence, America wouldn't be the type of government, or wouldn't have the type of government that it has.
That's very stale. Let's not be boring historians. Let's give it some real life and energy. How can we make this alive? Hey, that's here. King, bring this to life.
Without the signing of the Declaration of Independence, America would not exist. No America, that's where we live today.
Yeah, okay, but you know, I'm not so keen on the without the. Again, kind of a negative formulation, okay? This is the birth of the greatest country in the history of the world and the most important country in the world today. That's it. Okay? That's today, right? Today, the preeminent nation in the world was born in 1776. Okay? Make it alive. Make it alive. Back here. Back to the beginning. Okay? Who, Juliet?
Menes Narmer.
Timothy, what?
The unification of Egypt.
Okay, Sophie, when?
3000 BC.
Where? Egypt, of course. So what? Two good answers. Keen, what are they?
This is our anchor fact that shows us how the world worked from 3000 BC all the way up until America and the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, right. This is how the world we live in works if there's no America. Right? Monarchy. The rule of some elite group with a single leader over everybody else. This is how the world works. And then the other part of it is, this is how it has worked for 5,000 years. Actually, if we can combine those into a single statement, right? I think that would be the most succinct formulation. We could say, this is how the world has worked for 5,000 years. This is the norm for 5,000 years. Okay, the details change. But basically, the story's always the same. All of Chinese history, all of Indian history, all of Muslim history, all of the history of pre-Columbian America, all of European history. Where can you find anything other than this? Well, oh, actually, in two places. Who? Keen.
Greeks and the Romans.
Okay, Greeks and Romans, in particular Athenians and Romans. Okay, so we got to kind of do them separately. So, Keen, run me through the Greek one.
All right, so who, Greeks, what, Athens, or the Athenians? When, 50, was it 503?
508, we got to be more precise. The what you didn't quite get. What's the what?
Athenian democracy.
Democracy. Okay, when... 508 BC. So what? One of the two great examples before America. Timothy, do the Rome side.
Who? I guess you could say Rome.
Mm-hmm.
What? The Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm.
When? Circa 509, I think it was BC.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
Rome.
Rome.
So what?
So what is, this is the second great other type of government before America.
Right, the second precedent. These are, well, let's wrap those up with a bow. These are the two great precedents. Okay? This is an important word. Let me chat it to you guys. You can write it down and think about what it means. The two great precedents. Where is my chat window? There it is. Okay? Precedent. That's a great word. In the legal sphere, when laws are made and precedents are set, that's an important part of how laws are created is by precedent. But also in history, a thing that comes before, that precedes, serves as a useful and instructive example. That's a precedent. So, Athens, democracy. Rome, republic. 508, 509. These are the two great precedents. Other than that, it's the same old, same old. Same old, same old. Kings rule people. That's it. All right, so we're getting there. Okay, who can do this one quickly? Peyton, have you had a chance to practice these? What are the answers here? Psh, silence. I don't know what's going on. Are you there, Peyton? Okay, Ashton, please.
For what? So what?
Everything.
Oh, okay, everything?
Yeah, come on.
Sorry, I forget to have my,
You shouldn't need your pages. You shouldn't need your pages. This is supposed to be a visit to the doctor's office where he hits your kneecap with the little hammer and then your leg kicks out. So you're supposed to be at the point now where this is starting to become reflexive. So, okay, no more Mr. Nice Guy here from Mr. Powell, because you guys are... When you guys are not told what to do, you guys are kind of, okay, it's not important yet. All right, now I'm telling you, this has got to be reflexive. It's got to come out, uneffortful, completely automatic. Sophie.
Who is Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
What is the birth of Jesus?
Okay.
When is 4 BC?
Circa.
Where is Rome?
Okay.
And so what is, there would be no calendar.
No, don't say it. Don't say it negatively. Say it positively.
We would not benefit.
No, that's a negative. Don't say not or no or none of that. Say it positively. The calendar we use is based on this event. See how there's no negatives in there, right? The calendar we use comes from this. Also, another crucial thing. We could put comma. Reflecting what? Why does the calendar we use reflect this event? Timothy.
Because for a lot of history, after the birth of Jesus, Christianity was the main religion. So that's what they shaped the calendar after.
Okay, so it's still a little bit of a what answer that you're giving me. So let's change it into more of a so what answer, which means connected to the present. So we can, how can we do that, Juliet?
Christianity becomes the most important religion in the world and changes our calendar.
Okay, we got to kind of, it's like history through art, right? When we're coming up with that sentence, we need to kind of massage it a bit and make it as good as we can. So as a group, we're going to have to try to improve this formulation so that it becomes really, really tight. So it should be something like this. The calendar we use is based on this event. Because Christianity has been the most important religion in the history of the world, leading to the world we live in. There you go. Christianity is the most important religion in the history of the world, leading to the world we live in. If you had been living in 2000 BC, of course that statement would not be true. And even if you had been living in the world of about 500 AD... well, you might, if you were living in Europe, you might say Christianity is the most important religion in the world. But if you were living in China, you wouldn't even have heard of it. So that statement wouldn't even be relevant at that point. Really, in terms of statements concerning the history of the world, those only become kind of intelligible statements when you start to have globalization. When you start to have connections and you can make real comparisons. Because before globalization, everything's happening in separate little corners. Nobody in India is at all concerned with Christianity or what the Romans and the Germanic barbarians are doing. It's absolutely irrelevant. Nobody in the Aztec Empire, it didn't exist yet, but the previous ones, whatever they were called, the Toltecs and the Olmecs and all of those irrelevant early primitive societies in ancient Mesoamerica, they didn't know what was going on over here either, right? But in the world that we live in, Christianity is the most important religion in the history of our world. That's it. That's so what? It's us. It's here. It's now. Okay? So that's how we answer the so what. Okay, so, Sophie, put your hand down unless you have a follow-up on that particular one. So now, okay, who, what, when, where, so what? I know that you guys are not quite there yet, but some of you are. Keen?
All right, so who? Germanic barbarians.
Okay.
What? Sack of Rome.
Okay.
When? Pre-476 AD.
Okay.
I don't know. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, okay, that's a good question, a decent question. So I would say, Germanic barbarians, what caused the fall of Rome? Let's just put it in general, generic terms. Because there's no moment of sack in that exact year. But the reason it falls is because of the Germanic barbarians ruining Rome, right? So we could say, Germanic barbarians, what caused the sack, caused the fall of Rome? When? 476 is the year when it's all said and done. Where? Okay, Roman Empire again. And then so what? Well, we're kind of working on that one right now, but who's got a good so what here on this one? Who's got an attempted so what? Timothy?
This event made the world a mess, and if this event didn't happen, we'd probably all be speaking Latin.
You're on the right track. You're on the right track. Except what I would say was, what I would put it, if you want to be kind of humorous about it, is this event made the world a European mess instead of a Roman Empire. Because basically, had the Roman Empire not fallen and continued to grow and conquer, we might all be Romans today. It was, the Romans were really quite remarkable at certain things. They were great at war, which is, you know, neither good nor bad. It's just something you need to do sometimes. So they're great at war. They're also quite adept at organizing an imperial government. They were great at engineering. So they had some amazing skills. And if they had continued to be able to build their empire, which they couldn't because it was an empire. And empires are always oppressive, and they always peak and they always collapse. So, you know, there was a necessity of sorts to their collapse. But had they continued to grow, if they'd figured out how to work the formula a little bit better, they might have continued to grow and grow and grow. We might all be Romans now, and all speaking Latin, as you put it. But the more kind of positive statement of it is, Timothy, so what means... We live in a European world today, not a Roman one. That's why the fall of the Roman Empire is so important. We live in a European world today, not a Roman one. And the question is, really, when it comes to history, to me, there's no more important question right now in the world. The question is, whether or not we are going to make a transition to an American world or not. We do live in an America-centric world, but that's not the same thing. So this is where it's at with American history, with all of history, is looking at the world around us and deciphering what this cauldron, this bubbling cauldron is, with all of this horrible violence in the Middle East and all of this strange conflict in Ukraine. And the people of Europe, they can't figure out how to work out their union. And Venezuela and Argentina are going bankrupt, and so is Japan. And China has got more pollution than the rest of the world put together. And how is everybody going to get along? And so on and so forth. This seething cauldron, this world that we live in, it is America-centric, but it's obviously not American. A lot of the world looks at America and respects it and loves it and think that it's interesting. America itself is under transformation. It's not a stable thing. It was a certain thing when it was born. It has evolved very importantly over the course of its life. This world that we're in, to me, the question is whether or not the world can become American. And to me, that's the most important question, because America is this miraculous entry into the ledger. America is something absolutely fantastic and unique and special. When this happened, it broke the mold. When the founding fathers did this, they changed everything. When they said that every individual has a right to his own life, they were rebelling against the record of all mankind and saying, we know better. Monarchy is wrong. Individuals have the right to pursue their own happiness, and we are going to defend them in that right by making a republic once and for all that has the right arrangement of parts in its government so that the government may not rule the individual. And they did an amazing job of it. But things are changing. And to me, it is a very, very potent question whether, how long this will last, how long this thing that the Founding Fathers created will last. And it's, to me, it's a question that is relevant in my lifetime and relevant in your lifetimes, how long it will last. So history is just, it amazes me that people don't realize how important history is, because this thing that they take for granted, this United States of America, the center of the world, nothing in history so far is permanent. Things like this that are different and wonderful, they don't last. The Athenian democracy didn't last. The Roman Republic didn't last. Who says this one's going to last? There's only one way it can last, is if it's really properly constructed and defended constantly. And it's a really huge challenge. And quite frankly, Americans that I look around and I'm looking at are not up to the task. They don't know enough history. Keen.
One thing that I think the Founding Fathers just couldn't foresee was that the people would just stop caring and stop knowing.
They really couldn't see. They could not imagine what people are like today. They would be just stunned. Yeah, Peyton, did you have a question or comment there? They really could not foresee that. Yeah, how different people are today. They really thought that people would be very different. Yeah, so that's a very interesting comment, Peyton. People have changed. They want to watch the Jersey Shore on television. And they just are waiting for the latest phone, and they're not really looking around at the world that they live in and understanding how it works. So yeah, I agree. But they understood that if you educate people, they can care and they can be worthy of freedom. So they were very, very keen on that, and I completely agree with them. I believe in education. I would not be a history teacher if I didn't. I believe that you can learn this story, and you can understand it, and you can be people who are paying attention to the world around you and valuing the greatest values that we have, the freedom that the Founding Fathers gave, and defending it and improving it and working on that as a part of what you are and what you do every day. While you are a doctor or while you are a lawyer or while you are whatever it is you choose to be, but this is a part of who you are. So yeah, this is, so what's here are very, very powerful. They link up with everything about us and where we are now in this world. And of course, here's a very important symbol of that. Can America thrive in this world and grow in influence and be even greater than it has been? Well, who? Muslim terrorists. What? Destroyed the World Trade Center. When? On 9/11, 2001. Where? New York. So what? We live in the war on terror now. Americanism is under attack. Americanism is being challenged. Americanism is being transformed. This America-centric world is a cauldron, a seething cauldron of different peoples in different places struggling mightily to manage this challenge that is living in an interconnected world. It's a huge challenge. So, perfect segue here. Perfect segue is, even in the time of Columbus, in this much less connected world, people still did not know how to be connected. The challenges were quite a bit simpler than they are now. But they didn't know how to do it back then either. We've already talked about the separate tribes, like the Franks, that took over France. And the Angles and Saxons that took over England. And the Visigoths that took over Spain. We've talked about how, well, they migrated into these territories. They conquered Rome. They caused the fall of Rome. And then they ended up not being able to live together. So they huddled in these separate territories and fought to claim them and to make those claims relatively permanent and strong. So we've already seen that about them. And yesterday we've seen that huddled into these little territories with these borders here, those people came to adopt a certain way of organizing their lives, which is embodied in this diagram of their society. We can summarize the name of this, by the way. I didn't name it the other day. But we can summarize the name of this way of organizing society as feudalism. So it's called that because the land is broken up into pieces called feuds. So this society of feudalism had very peculiar attributes. One of them is there's a king at the top. Well, here we go, back to our anchor facts. Why is there a king at the top? Make reference to an anchor fact in your answer. Why is there a king at the top, Alexander?
Because Menes Narmer started that, and so for a long time, everybody had a king at the top.
Yeah, pretty close, right? I wouldn't necessarily Menes Narmer started that. That's a little bit of a tricky statement. I mean, well, let's put it this way. He's the first one we know about in exact terms. But basically what that says to us is, ever since the beginning of recorded history, this is what human beings do. So, in other words, why would the European barbarians be any different? Did they have anything going for them that would make that would allow them to understand that this isn't good enough? That this is not a proper human way of life? What did they know? They were barbarians. They were tribal barbarians. And by this point, even the Romans had forgotten what it was to live in a republic. So nobody knew. So every time you get back to basics, you get back to, in a way, it's kind of like, remember how we were talking at the beginning of the year about tabula rasa? Do you guys remember that? What Aristotle said about human beings? We were comparing Aristotle to Socrates, and Aristotle said human beings are tabula rasa when they are born. What did he mean by that? Juliet?
Humans are a blank slate.
A blank slate, right? And so we have to turn on our minds and perceive the world, use those minds and think and grasp the world, and then we populate our minds with the content that goes in there, but we start off with nothing. And so, in a way, history is an eloquent illustration of this particular point of view. Because when the barbarians wiped the slate, they got rid of all the progress that had ever been made by the Greeks and the Romans. What happened? Where did they go back to? What did they go back to when they had wiped the slate of all of the accumulated knowledge of the Romans and the Greeks? King. Sorry, go ahead.
They just went right back to Menes Narmer.
They went right back to Menes Narmer. They went back to the beginning. How could they do anything else? When human beings have this problem, how do we organize our society? And they don't know any better. They adopt, sadly, when they don't know any better, Right? When they haven't accumulated an experience and knowledge and awareness and any wisdom whatsoever with regard to this question, when the slate is wiped clean, human beings look around and they say, how do you do it? How do you organize different people together? And they come up with what is a very facile answer. There's a reason why it's universal. And it's really simple. If you look at the smallest social units among human beings, what's the smallest social unit of human beings living together and functioning together as more than one person? What's the smallest social unit, Alexander?
Family?
Yeah, a family, right? And so, yeah, even a couple would be an example of a family in a sense. And what do you notice all the way up until the 20th century about families? A family is a very standard type of a thing, right? There's a man, and he's big, and he's strong, and there's a woman, and they have babies. And who's in charge? The one that's big and strong, right? Because when you have arguments between human beings, and they can't figure it out and they don't know any better, it's not so much about who's the smartest and it's not so much about who's the wisest. It's about who, when finally the chips are down, who can beat everybody else and force them to do what he wants. And that's the definition in most of history for the term father. So, and the Romans knew this. They called him the pater familias. And in the pater familias, he could do anything with the lives of all of the members of his family. It's the same everywhere in the world. You look in Chinese culture, the family is ruled by the dominant, the elders, basically. The family is the crucial unit of social organization. If you try to imagine how to make everybody into a family as a very simple way of looking at the world, well, you imagine that you need a father at the top. A single man who's going to be in charge. It's so simple, and yet it encounters, obviously, even at the level of a family, if it's based on ultimate authority is based on the use of force and violence, well, even that, now we're in trouble, right? Nowadays, in our civilized existence, are family units allowed to be managed by the use of force? I hope you know the answer to that. Right? There are some notorious examples out there right now. Adrian Peterson, the football player. And what was that other guy? Ray Rice, the other football player. You paying attention to any of those news items? Is violence an acceptable recourse in the management of families? Absolutely not. So today, we are so fortunate to live in a more civilized society. But the truth is, in most of human history, it was not surprising that when people made governments, they couldn't come up with anything better either. It's really simple until you think it through more clearly. So, and it takes a while. It takes a lot of accumulated wisdom, a lot of accumulated thought, in order for people to attain that awareness and to say, wait a minute, this model doesn't work. It doesn't even work for families. We have to have a society. If we want to flourish as human beings, we have to banish the use of force from our relationships, even our family relationships. This barbaric way of doing things, it's not the right way for human beings to live. If we're going to live as humans, we need to respect what we are. And live accordingly. So anyway, the Europeans didn't know any better, right? So they went right back to Mannes and Armour. It's a total rewind to 3000 BC. They're going to do things exactly the same way. This arrangement over here is a little bit different, right? Because you might know, the Egyptians had multiple gods and they had different arrangements. In Egypt, the Pope and the King were the same person. Right? In Egypt, that was a double role. Right? He was called the Pharaoh. He was a god king. In a way, he was almost all of these wrapped up into one. So the arrangements change at the top, but in a European society, there's a very unique arrangement. What anchor fact accounts for this particular difference? Alexander?
The birth of Jesus?
Of course, right? We're dealing with now a unique set of tenets concerning a belief in a single God and a way of following that belief, an organized manner of following that with a church that has all these officials in it who are going to promote that belief to everybody else. So we've got Manes Narmer over here. We have the birth of Jesus and the religion that follows that over here. We've got separate countries because of the fall of Rome. So this arrangement is a specific kind of circumstance in European history, in world history, as it was in Europe. Okay, now today I want to talk about the peculiar way in which this worked out in the story of France and England. So here we have, again, back to our map, Columbus's time. We've got two of the most important countries. We have France and we have England. And these are going to be countries that come across and participate in the Age of Discovery, right? France, England. Soon enough, New France, New England, and all that other stuff along there, right? It's the colonies that formed America eventually. It's going to be France and England over here. These are major players. So we need to be oriented to, at least, if we haven't already studied European history, we need to know about these countries. What were they? And what were they in particular to each other? Because that's what matters in our story. So the answer is, I'll give you the answer before I tell you how we get to the answer. The answer is, I like to joke. You know how people nowadays, they call each other BFFs, right? So you know what BFF stands for, obviously, right? Best friends forever. So that's what everybody's texting themselves, texting to each other or whatever, right, these days. All right, so, well, France and England, I have a special term for them. France and England were WEFs. So if a French person was texting an English person in 1492, he wouldn't be typing best friends forever. He'd be typing WEF, worst enemies forever. So why is that? What had happened to make France and England worst enemies forever? Well, we already know the beginning of the story. We already know that two different sets of tribes had settled in these separate countries. Right? The Franks had settled in France, and the Angles and Saxons had settled in England. So they were already different groups, did not seek to live together, were happy to be apart. So that's 1,000 years before Columbus. The question now is, that's 1,000 years before Columbus. So that's way back. I'm trying to get to something else here. I apologize for the jumpy imagery. All right, but the Angles and Saxons is, and then the Franks, is right after the fall of Rome. And these are guys that are kind of living in this particular period of history. Right here. Sometimes I can't get the annotation to work. Sorry. They're right here. Okay? What we're asking about is, we only starting to get Franks and Angles over here, separate anyway. And the question we're trying to ask is, and answer is, what happened in between this and this to shape the world that Columbus lived in and to shape the world that was globalized by these peoples? Okay, that's the question that we're asking. So after the tribal settlements, another influence was injected into the story. Let me bring that up on screen now. Back to here. Way back in history, when all of this is still taking shape, barely, if we go down to the bottom here, France and England are barely taking shape, and the details of all of these differences just doesn't matter to us. But when they were barely taking shape, another group injected itself into the mix and caused a lot of trouble. That group was from the north. And it went everywhere. They went here, they went here, they went here, here, and here. So they went everywhere. And since they were from the north, at the time they were known as the Northmen. And we call them typically the Vikings today. And the Northmen managed to settle down in both England and France in different areas. In particular, in France, they settled down in this area right here, which is labeled in pink, which became known after them. It became known as Normandy, which is obviously kind of a short version. Northmen can be shortened as Norman. So this pink area in France came to be known as Normandy, and they settled down there. They conquered it. They took it from the French. They ended up making a bargain with the French king. The bargain was that the Normans would settle there if they would become servants of the French king. So a deal was struck, and they accepted that role. And in particular, the leader of the Normans became one of the trusted servants of the king of France. He became the Duke of Normandy. Key word for English history, and even relevant for American history. He became the Duke of Normandy. So if we go back to this diagram of feudalism, right? We've got the King of France, and now we have this Norman character who comes in because the Normans managed to carve out a piece of France, and one of them becomes the Duke of a territory within France called Normandy. So far, all this just sounds like Europe, right? It just sounds like a whole bunch of what. What is the so what? We're working our way there. We're working our way there, right? The so what, actually, we do know the so what. We're waiting for the punchline here, which is worst enemies forever. So how does this story evolve in that direction? Well, oops, wrong window. In 1066... the Duke of Normandy, who was a servant of the King of France, conquered England. So those of you who have studied European history with me know that 1066 is one of the anchor facts of European history. A really crucial milestone. In 1066, the Duke of Normandy, whose name was William, conquered England. So thereafter in history, he is known as William the Conqueror. And this created a very strange situation. Before this, looking back at this map, perhaps we could say, the land of the Angles and the land of the Franks were separate. The tribes were separate. The languages were separate. But now, a connection was made, which is shown by this kind of pinkish hue, right? That's this pinkish hatching that is added to our map. The Duke of Normandy was now the King of England, and he had this, and he had this too, a part of France. Now, the connection, and the reason why France and England became worst enemies forever, has to do with, if you go and you look at the way European society is supposed to work, a duke, such as the Duke of Normandy, is always supposed to be the servant of a king. In European history, that's known as a vassal, some of you will remember. A duke is always underneath and to be the servant of a king. Now, what was strange about this situation was that a duke had gone and become a king somewhere else, creating a strange arrangement. The question was he now a duke or was he a king? And the answer is he was both. One of the servants of the King of France was now King of England also. So who remembers from European history what this leads to? Someone being a duke and a king at the same time. Can you be both a ruler of a country and the servant of the ruler of a country at the same time? What happened as a result? Timothy.
Eventually, these events, they led up to the Hundred Years' War, which is what made France and England worst enemies
forever. Yeah, you're jumping ahead, though. You didn't really answer my question. You told me where this leads. So what was the problem, Keen?
You can't really have dual loyalty. Your interests are split. As the king of one country and the duke of another, you have split interests. So you end up not being able to serve both countries the best. Your people get angry, and it doesn't work out.
Yeah, right. You can't be a duke and a king at the same time. You can't be a ruler and a servant at the same time, right? You can be a ruler at one point and a servant at the other point, but it's really, really hard to manage, as Keane is saying. So this situation became unworkable. It became especially unworkable because by this point, we're looking at 1213 here, by this point, the Dukes of Normandy had come into possession of almost all, more than half of France. So they were kings of England, they also were kings of Ireland by this point, and Wales, and now they were also, essentially, the rulers of half of France. So naturally, the kings of France and the king of England were always in a really tense relationship. How are they supposed to behave towards each other? Who's in charge? You would think it would be the king of France, because it's his servant who is the Duke of Normandy and the ruler of these lands and also the King of England. But they're two kings, so they were always arguing about what their proper relationship should be. And as Timothy points out, this argument without end, it was an argument without end, ever since 1066 in a sense, ever since William. This argument without end led to a war. It's known as the Hundred Years' War. And I'm going to illustrate it on the next map with Columbus in it, right? 1492. So the Hundred Years' War between these two kings lasted from 1337 to 1453. Hopefully you can read that. You know what? I'm going to move it over a bit. But you can read it, right? I know it's a little annoying. It didn't fit right there, but... Okay? The Hundred Years' War, 1337 to 1453. The never-ending argument between the Dukes of Normandy and the Kings of France resulted in a war between those countries, the details of which cannot concern us in this class, obviously. But what happens when two countries have a war between them for what, as it turns out, technically was 116 years? What do they become? What I have jokingly referred to as WEFs. Doesn't quite roll off the tongue like BFFs, but they become WEFs, right? They become worst enemies forever. I mean, what? Imagine yourself growing up in France in 1452. Imagine yourself for a moment. Transplant yourself back to 1452 in France. What are the stories that you are told? What is it that your parents have lived through their entire lives and their parents before them? And which is basically deeply embedded in the experience of every human being. War with England. Invasions by English kings. Bloody battles, death, destruction, all of the horrors of a regular conflict for 116 years. So, yes, in the end, in 1453, this comes to an end. And the outcome of the war is finally the two countries are separated. France is France, no more pink stuff in the middle of it. England is England. The two countries are separated. But the outcome is a scar on the souls of Frenchmen and a scar on the souls of Englishmen, which says those people over there are our worst enemies forever. And that story gets passed down generation after generation. It's embedded in the way that people think about each other. It's this festering wound. So by the time of 1492, it's hardly a surprise that this is just deeply a part of the identity of the two countries. Worst enemies forever. All right, that is another ingredient in our context for American history. Tribal peoples with separate languages in different corners, organized into kingdoms, with two kingdoms in particular, France and England, worst enemies forever. All right, that's good enough for today. We'll pick this up tomorrow with Spain and Portugal. We'll see how they are going to get along. You can probably guess. All right. Keep working on those anchor facts, folks. Every day now, you should be just really drilling those. They're going to be a huge part of everything we do going forward. Good luck with that. Talk to you guys tomorrow.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.